I said to a friend of mine who, excellent, you know, elite runner, we were chatting one day about, I think the New York City Marathon. And I said, hey, I said, you and like 10 other people have a chance of winning this. The other 50,000 of us are running for something else. And what we're running for, as you know, is always that sense of just how did I do? I'm competitive, but what I'm mainly competitive against is the distance, the day, and what I bring to it. I have had races where I have not finished very well, but I've been extremely proud of the race because under the conditions, that everything that led to that moment, I ran a really smart, really good race. I've had other races that I have run, arguably a very good race, but I didn't come away saying it was wonderful. I was like my biggest accomplishment that is measurable by some standard that other people would look at, other than qualifying for Boston, would be a 1 year for my age group, I won third place at the Cleveland Marathon. And I was like, woohoo! But it wasn't a great race for me. And I didn't run a brilliant race. I think it was just a really hot day, and somehow I survived it better than some other people did.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Tom Foreman. On Instagram, he goes by Tom Foreman CNN because he is a correspondent for the news network CNN. We spent a few moments talking about the news business before we get into his stories about running. And Tom wrote a book called My Year of Running Dangerously. So we start off kind of talking about what he means by running dangerously. And as usual, our conversation then winds into other areas of life and running. I had a lot of fun in this conversation. I hope you have a lot of fun listening to it. Here is my conversation with Tom Foreman. Great. I appreciate you being here.
I'm happy to be here.
So what, tell me, what do you do for CNN? I mean, I know you work for CNN. I mean, what's your role there?
I'm a correspondent. I've been covering the news since high school, really. I started in radio, so I've done this for more than 40 years.
Wow.
And then I've been with CNN for about 20 years, give or take a year or something like that.
Yeah. So how have you noticed what kinds of things have changed in your
in the news business?
Yeah, in the news business. Anything changed in the last?
Everything has changed in the news business. There's everything. I mean, technologically, it's changed immensely. When I first started, we were really in sort of the first generation of truly portable video cameras of higher quality. So There were many, many communities that I went to when I first started out where I was the first person there with a TV camera, which sounds crazy, but that's the way it was back then. And that was a very exciting and interesting time. And the art of learning how to tell a story and tell it well and informatively and fairly through television was developing at the same time. And things have changed. The immediacy of television, especially with social media, has grown faster, which interestingly enough, I've grown slower. that's also really raised the bar on people learning to be quick and accurate and good and ethical, everything all at once. It's quite a challenge, particularly for young people coming into the business.
Yeah. And people's expectations, I'd imagine, have changed as well. I mean,
expect. Oh, yeah. Well, and that's one of the, I think Bill Clinton said one time, somebody asked him what he envied about earlier presidents. And he said, I envy their time. Democrat or Republican, the idea that they had time to think about an issue before they responded.
Right.
So if there was some big development overseas or in Central America, a president might spend hours or even days formulating a response before they came out and said, here's what I think about it. Whereas a president now or any political leader may be in the middle of a news conference. And in the middle of it, somebody may say, Mr. President, I just got a tweet that says this happened. How do you respond?
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult for any of these leaders, whether you like them or not. That's a challenge.
Yeah, that would be a challenge. And people expect, I think the audience's expectation has become more immediate. You know, like they, mm-hmm. they want to know. And
I think one of the hardest things for leaders of any type and for journalists is to say, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a powerful thing, an important thing to say, because sometimes things are evolving so quickly. Someone says to you, well, why didn't the police do this? Or why didn't the pilot land over here? Or why didn't this party respond this way? Or why did this team do this? And sometimes the real answer is to say, I don't know. It's too early.
Mm-hmm.
Or I just don't have that information. And I think a lot of people in our society, not just journalists, many people, I think want to see that as a kind of weakness. They're you're not very strong. You're not very smart.
Mm-hmm.
I've always said the smartest people I know, the strongest people I know, say I don't know very easily because they know it's important. You don't learn unless you say I don't know. Nobody can tell you what you need to know. And in my experience, they also say I was wrong and I am sorry very
mm-hmm.
easily.
Mm-hmm.
The people who won't say I'm wrong and I was sorry generally to me are weak people.
Yes. Yeah. Or insecure. Yeah.
Insecure people. Yeah. And that's, and if ultra running teaches you anything, it teaches you to recognize your frailties because they are coming for you.
Yes. Well, it's interesting. You know, you talk about being older. The older I get, the less certain I am of what I know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, because you become aware of how many things you thought you knew that you were incorrect about.
Mm-hmm.
Will Rogers very famously said something like, it's not what we don't know that hurts us. It's what we know that ain't so.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I remind myself of that all the time. Things you are certain of, you find yourself saying, okay, should I have been certain of that? Or is that just an idea I have in my head because of the way I was raised or the people I'm around?
Mm-hmm.
Really, when we talk about diversity, I realize some people get upset about the term. Some people get upset because they feel like we don't have too much. Some people feel like we have too much. Some people think we don't have enough. Either way, the real value of diversity to me is seeing the ideas that you didn't encounter before and understanding that maybe for other people, those ideas are very natural. And to them, they were convinced that that's the way it ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
And your idea may be very different. Well, I don't really care who's right or wrong. What I'm interested in is why does this group think this and why does another group think that? And is there a meeting point for the two groups?
Yeah. And I have found a lack of willingness to engage in a conversation with people you don't agree with. And
there's a lot of that now.
Yeah.
I heard a term for it, and I can't remember what the term is. It goes beyond a hyper-partisanship, and it goes beyond negative partisanship. But this idea of simply saying the opposition, whatever the opposition is actually evil
mm-hmm.
and wrong and
mm-hmm.
an enemy. And I don't know, there are people in the world who are evil and wrong and who are enemies, I guess. I know. But there are a lot of other people who you disagree with who, I guess the model was this. We always have had political differences in this country. We haven't always wanted to burn down the other person's house, right?
That's true.
We were able to say, I disagree with you, but you're going to be at the baseball game Saturday. Yeah, I'll see you there.
Mm-hmm.
People did that all the time.
Yeah.
And now we're a little bit more like, no, I disagree with you. Now you have to cease existing, which doesn't seem like
that's extreme.
Well, anyway.
Yeah. So yeah, I
those understand. Those are changes in our business since I started.
that's good. So I actually contacted you to talk about running. So
yeah, so let's chat.
I thought, you know, a lot of times I have this kind of format that I have gotten into, and I thought I would break that with you. I think you'd be adaptable enough. So I thought I would just kind of jump right in and ask what is it that you talk about when you talk about running dangerously? I know that's
well, the reason I called the book My Year of Running Dangerously was essentially because I went in such a short period of time from being a Midland runner, somebody who played at it as many of us did as we grew older, and we didn't have the time, we didn't have the commitment of our youth, we didn't have the legs of our youth. And I went in such a short period of time from kind of playing at it to in a single year, not only returning to marathoning, but doing 4 half marathons, 3 full marathons, and my first 50-mile ultra all in 1 year.
Wow. Okay.
That was a lot to fit into a short span of time, especially since until I started that, I had really questioned whether or not I could even marathon again. Because marathons take time and they take effort. And I had done them in my 20s, but I hadn't done them in a long time. But my older daughter asked me if I would help her train for one. She was just in college. And we do many things for our children. And mm-hmm. So I said, mm-hmm. sure, I'll try. And as I have often said, the real difference was this. When I was young, as a natural runner, I barely trained for any race. And I often won. Well, as I grew older for the first time in my life, and I was in my early 50s, I thought, I don't think I can get away with that anymore. I don't mm-hmm. think I can fake my way through. So for the first time ever, I actually trained. And I found the training process to be really remarkable and wonderful. So when I finished that first race, I wanted to go on to the next one and the next one. And since then, you know, when the book came out to promote the book, I did a few sort of stunt things. Like I ran the Chicago Marathon. 2 weeks later, I ran 5 marathons in 5 days, one of which was the Marine Corps Marathon. 2 days after that, I ran the New York City Marathon. And 2 weeks after that, I did a 50-miler.
Wow. Okay.
And that was the most mileage I did in a short period of time. Now, you talk to Mike Wardian, you talk to Camille Herron, you talk to people like that, and they'll say, oh, so you were warming up. Like, no, yes. No, that was it. That was the pinnacle. That was the top. But it was, for me, it was a great experiment, and I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was really interesting. And that year, the year of running dangerously, and then leading up to those runs later on, that was really the time when I came to understand the whole concept of ultra running and how very different that is from marathoning or 10Ks or whatever it is. And I really think they're wildly different. There are extremely gifted athletes who can drift back and forth between all those forms very, very well. Mm-hmm. I can drift back and forth between all those forms, but not very well. So I really came to appreciate that ultra running is an art of its own and a particular kind of zen of its own. It's even in the special world of long distance running, ultra running is its own very special category.
Yeah. So what is what was your kind of observation about the difference between, I mean, so you said Zen, but I mean, so you've drifted back and forth. What's kind of your different approach between the two?
The difference to me is in ultra running, it's a lot more about, to me, getting into a type of flow that feels as if it can simply go forever. Mm-hmm. And appreciating the process of running more than the goal of running. And appreciating the movements of running. And the movements, I mean, the ups and the downs. Mm-hmm. Typically in a shorter race, and I'll even include the marathon as a shorter race in that case, although I think the marathon is just a really an absolutely perfect race. I think the length of the marathon, everything about it is a lovely, lovely race. Typically, if you get on the wrong side of the curve in a marathon, because you're trying to run for speed, because you're looking at certain splits, because you're putting a certain effort in, if you get on the wrong side of that and you start having a bad race, I don't think there's typically enough time and space to get back on the right side. Mm-hmm. If you start crashing at 15, 16, 17 miles, I don't think in that last 9, 10 miles, you're going to necessarily magically come back.
Mm-hmm. You would probably finish, but you wouldn't.
You'll finish. You'll finish. Of course, yeah, you'll finish, right? But it won't be the race you wanted because you don't have enough time and space for it to be the race you wanted. But in ultra running, to me, I was really struck by the notion that you could have these very bad periods. If you're in, you know, you're running hills all day, you're up and down, you know, you can hit a very bad stretch of hills that just kind of sap you, or the temperature gets crazy on you, and you're wiped out. And you're saying, wow, I've got 20 miles in front of me, and I feel like I can't go more than 20 feet. Mm-hmm. But I learned in that process, oh no, there's more out there. Just take your time. Cruise a little bit, feel it a little bit, let it come back to you. And I found these waves in ultra running that I did not find in any other races, where you start feeling better and then you go on for a while. And then maybe you feel worse for a while. But you learn a lot more, to me, about dealing with your head in ultra running. And, you know, Muhammad Ali very famously was asked one time, what was it like to be punched by Joe Frazier? And he said, it's like your whole body jangles and you don't even know where you are. But that's when you have to rely on your training to keep you moving around until your head clears and you can start fighting again. And I've thought of that many times when I'm in a bad moment in a very long ultra race, where you're able to say, okay, you have the training. This is miserable. You feel bad right now. Don't worry about the next 15 miles. Just worry about the next quarter mile, mm-hmm. or half mile, mm-hmm. and see if it comes back to you. And I was really startled to learn how much it does come back to you. And that's a great feeling. And that's something when I talk about the zen of ultra running. You know, the last one I ran last fall, which was my fifth Stone Mill 50 miler, Stone Mill, great race, great people, wonderful folks. I was having an okay race, not the best, but good, you know, and having a good time. And it had turned dark again after running all day. And all of a sudden, these owls appeared overhead, and the moon had suddenly appeared. And as I ran in the woods, I heard all these owls just light up in the trees.
Wow.
And they were just calling to each other. And I was like, this is what this day was for. This is the moment. Mm-hmm. Every mile, every moment, this is what really mattered, to be here for this moment. And I only got here by doing all the other moments. And it was beautiful. It was wonderful. And, you know, it was great.
Yeah, those moments that come when you're out like that, it's special. It's like, and they're also fleeting. It's that, because, you know, oftentimes I think, you know, runners who are in ultras, I mean, if you're not used to those ups and downs, you can get on an up cycle and you feel like you can go forever. And then that feeling also goes away.
Yeah. So. Right. I'm always amazed at those ultra runners who are incredibly even. Mm-hmm. No matter where you find them in the race, they are exactly the same. And I'm always amazed at those people, because I'm like, man, I don't know how you get this groove going, but that's pretty cool. They're often not very fast, but I'm not very fast. That's how I run into them, because we're at the same place in the race. but they're just very, very cool with it, very chill, kind of running along, having a good time. And I try to remind myself of that at all times. It's like, just, you know, here you are. This is your moment. Enjoy it. You chose to be here. You're doing something that is rare in the human experience and lovely in the human experience. And it's a great thing. You know, it's a good feeling. And the best thing is when you're eager for the race to end because you're tired, but you're able to have that little part of your head that says, and it's a shame it's ending, mm-hmm. because it was such a nice day.
Yeah. And that's it. It is uncanny to have that feeling. It's like, when will this be over? And then, and then it's over too soon. And,
Well, that's how I feel running Boston.
Yes.
Boston in particular. It's like, it's such a beautiful, magnificent race. You're laying it down. You hit that last little stretch down towards the Sitco sign. And you're thinking, this is magnificent. And it's over.
Mm-hmm.
What a shame.
Yeah.
It was so great, you know.
And you ran Boston this year as well as Big Sur.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Have you run Boston multiple times then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was my fourth Boston. I'm going up to Erie this fall to try to qualify to run Boston again next spring, which is partially part of it is just I have so many friends who are at Boston, and it's so great to see them. And it's just kind of hard to, at this point now, to think, oh, well, if they're going to have the whole party, I should be there. My wife and I, we're New Orleans people, and it's a little bit of how we are about Mardi Gras. It's like, well, Mardi Gras is happening. It'd be a shame not to be there because, all our friends are there and we're supposed to be there.
So you don't have to you have to qualify each year at a separate race for Boston. If they won't take your time.
No, you can. No, if I were fast enough, thank you for pointing that out, Eric. If I'd been a little faster at Boston this spring, I would have qualified. I wouldn't have had to do a separate race. But no, those of us who aren't that fast have to try again.
I kind of thought, running Boston, it was like, well, you can come back again next year because you've proved you can do it.
If you're fast enough, right? Okay. I was off of my qualifying time in Boston by 6 minutes, something like that.
Okay, so
it wasn't impossible.
It's not just finishing Boston. You have to finish within their set time frame.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I can do that. It's not beyond my reach at all. Erie is a really good race to do it. It's a flat double loop course out on an island right outside of Erie. A very nice race. They do a good job up there. And although I don't typically like a double loop, this one is packed with people trying to get late Boston qualifications. Yeah. So you have a fast field, which helps kind of drag you along. It's all good. So hopefully that'll be nice. And I don't know, my next ultra, I'm very tempted to come out of the backside of qualifying for Boston and then turn around and do Stone Mill again this fall. However, this goes to my theme about the different preparations for different races. When you're unless you're a very gifted athlete, training for an ultra does not prepare you to run your best marathon.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a very different kind of running.
Yeah.
And the opposite is also true. Training for a really good marathon, if I do decide to do Stone Mill again, what I would need to do is turn around right after qualifying for Erie, which is, I think, September 11th. I would immediately need to turn around and follow it up with more, some longer runs, just more time on my feet, slower runs. Although if I slow down much more, I'll be arrested for loitering. but just sort of and work my way toward it. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it. My older daughter, she's getting married out in LA in October. So we're going to be very busy with wedding stuff. And I'm not sure that I can fit in the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I may be skipping Stone Mill this fall, but we'll see.
So you had said that you had in your younger years were able to win races without training.
Mm-hmm.
And then now as you're older, you're training. Are you still have that competitive feeling of like, I need to win this race?
No, because it's never going to happen. if I had a real threat of doing that, sure.
So I guess, how did you make that good? Because I know a lot of people who are highly competitive. That's a difficult, it's difficult. I hear runners talking about, as I get older, I'm going to slow down. How long will I continue to run?
Because I didn't train when I was younger, the fastest marathon of my life was when I was 52, something like that, 53.
Okay.
Fastest one of my life. I absolutely could have been faster when I was younger if I'd ever trained.
Mm-hmm.
I look back now and I think, oh, yeah, I could have been a much faster runner. But I had other things I was interested in, too. So I'm not worried about that. I still think I could have my fastest marathon in front of me. I don't know that. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible. And partially, I think that because I look at people like Gene Dykes, you know, who is, what is Gene? He's over 70 now or something, and he's still hovering around a 3-hour marathon. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The beast. Unbelievable.
Yes.
So I know there are ways this kind of thing can be put together. Whether or not I'm the person to put it together, whether or not I want to put together all that effort, I don't know. But mainly, I mean, one of the things I really love about running is, I said to a friend of mine who, excellent, you know, elite runner, we were chatting one day about, I think, the New York City Marathon. And I said, hey, I said, you and like 10 other people have a chance of winning this. The other 50,000 of us are running for something else. Mm-hmm. And what we're running for, as you know, is always that sense of just how did I do? I'm mm-hmm. competitive, but what I'm mainly competitive against is the distance, the day, and what I bring to it. Mm-hmm. I have had races where I have not finished very well, but I've been extremely proud of the race because under the conditions, that everything that led to that moment, I ran a really smart, really good race. I've had other races that I have run, arguably a very good race, but I didn't come away saying it was wonderful. I was like, my biggest accomplishment that is measurable by some standard that other people would look at, other than qualifying for Boston, would be a 1 year for my age group, I won third place at the Cleveland Marathon. Mm-hmm. And I was like, woohoo!
Podium finish, yeah.
It wasn't a great race for me. And I didn't run a brilliant race. I think it was just a really hot day, and somehow I survived it better than some other people did. Mm-hmm. That didn't make it a great race. It's nice to get the little trophy, but I'm like, yeah, I didn't run a great race. I have other races where I, you know, I got the medal at the end and that was it. But boy, am I proud of those races because they were beautiful races. You know, and that's, and the older I get, the more that's what I care about. The more I care about the notion of, can it just be a beautiful moment? Something that flows together in a wonderful way and makes you say, all right, I contributed something to the good of humanity. I don't know what it is. Because I always feel that way about athletics. Well, not even just about athletics, about art as well. I think, I believe very much, and especially the older I get, I believe very much in the idea of you try to do things well, not because it will bring you individual honor or fame or attention, although it may do all of those things, but because you become part of that rising tide that lifts all boats. It expands the imagination of people about what humans can do. If you run well and you're in your 20s or your 30s or your 50s or whatever it is, you make people think, oh, well, that's possible. That's not beyond the reach mm-hmm. of what people can do. And that's a good thing. You know, if you make a great, you do a great painting, you learn piano, you start when you're 55 learning piano. If you learn to do it, it shows other people it can be done. Mm-hmm. And that's a nice thing. You know, so I believe a lot in that kind of thing. And I love, like you can't imagine, Eric, I always say to people, I know no other community of athletes more welcoming than ultra runners. Mm-hmm. The longer the race, the more welcoming people are. And I believe that's because, one, it's a smaller community. There's virtually no fame in it. I mean, who recognizes ultra runners except other ultra runners? Yeah. Nobody. And because all of us know on any given day, the best runner out there may not make it. Mm-hmm. This may not be his or her day. And so I think there's something that's very leveling and wonderful about that. And I like the fact that the ultra community is so encouraging. And I have not had I don't think I've had an ultra race yet that I haven't been encouraged by another runner and that I haven't encouraged another runner. Mm-hmm. And I love seeing the way people put things together in the back end of a race when people are struggling and you see some people get together and say, hey, we're all in trouble here. Let's try. Let's try to get each other through the next couple of miles. It's a great thing, you know?
Yeah, that is that. And they're also extremely durable. I ran, in fact, she was a podcast guest, Mandy Miller. We ran, she was finishing up her 100K at Javelina. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I had done the Jackass, so I was just, and it was the final mile, final 2 miles or so. And she and I had passed each other back and forth. And so ended up running the last part of the race with her and had a great conversation. She is a friend of Sabrina Stanley, who's a professional ultra runner, said she'd introduced me to Sabrina, and because of the introductions, she came on the podcast. But I found out later that Mandy had broken a couple of ribs 15 miles into her 100K.
Good gracious.
I didn't find that out until I read her social media post afterwards. She, in the final 3 miles we ran together, she never mentioned that she'd broken ribs earlier.
Oh, wait. So. There's a runner around here in DC, Bob Gaylord, who, I don't know, was older than me, a pretty good bit. And Bob broke a couple of ribs at the Massanutten just a couple months ago, and he finished and just, you know, came in all twisted up. Ultra runners. Oh, that's the other. Interesting question. I will ask you because you're more experienced than I am. One of the interesting challenges of ultra running, and I mention this particularly when I'm talking to other runners who are saying, who have never done it, who'd like to try mm-hmm. it, you know? I said, one of the secrets of ultra running is learning that switch in your head that says, I've gone as far as I can go, mm-hmm. that switch is actually not correct. Mm-hmm. It's correct for your comfort. It is not correct for your capability. Mm-hmm. And people are shocked when I say, in my experience, when you reach the point of saying, I don't think I can go any further, in my experience, you have probably about 20 miles left in you, mm-hmm. even though you don't think so. And people always kind of roll their eyes and go, oh, my God, that's impossible. I'm like, well, it is possible. But here's the interesting part about this. How do you know the difference between I'm very tired and I'm hurting and I am actually hurt and I'm doing damage? How do you know the difference?
How do I know the difference? If you are a business owner or an entrepreneur, you know all about stress. Business owners and ultramarathon runners both have to have a strong mindset, but the difference is that business owners and entrepreneurs tend to ignore the warning signs of stress and burnout. When you run an ultramarathon, you push your body to the limit, and you have to manage your energy in an ultramarathon to be successful and make it to the finish line. But when you run an ultramarathon, you get to rest and recover when your race is over. If you're a business owner, you tend to feel like you're in a race with no finish line. In ultramarathon, they call those the last man standing, and you, the strongest, survive. If you're a business owner and you're not careful, you could be one of those who ends up blowing up and not finishing, breaking your body. Business owners tend to keep pushing until something breaks. As a mindset coach, I help business owners manage their energy, de-stress their life, and be profitable as well as healthy and successful. If you are in that situation, contact me at ultramindsetpodcast.run. That's ultramindsetpodcast.run for a free 25-minute mindset reset. I can help you keep from burning yourself out, managing your energy for success.
How do you know the difference between I'm very tired and I'm hurting and I am actually hurt and I'm doing damage? How do you know the difference?
How do I know the difference? By continuing to go on and see how I feel. Usually if I'm doing damage, it's difficult to know. I mean, my 100 mile, it's my first attempt at 100 miles was a DNF. It was, again, weather conditions that, you know, slowed me down. Mm-hmm. So 6 weeks later, I did another, and at about 58 miles in, felt like somebody had stuck a knife in the top of my foot and dragged it up my shin. I had not loosened my shoes enough, and the tendons in the top of my foot were irritated. I thought that I was going to have another DNF. I mean, that was my first thought. But then I had to readjust my mind. It was like, no, I can still walk. You know, I can't run, but I can still walk. And I can get about a mile before it happens again. And so I went mile to mile for about 10 miles until the until I was able to walk continuously. I still couldn't run, but I had a, you know, I walked about a 15 minute mile for the next 10. And then just for the last, you know, 10 or 12 miles, just hung on and did the best I could. Mm-hmm. But it was, it for me, it is just there. It's not a clear cut and dried. I was able to continue without pain for a while. If it had been a constant pain, I probably would have said, yeah, I this is too much. But people I know have finished their race with a stress fracture in their, you know, with stress fractures, mm-hmm. and continue. One guy that I run with, he had a stress fracture, I think at 60 miles. And he said, I may never do this again. I'm not going to stop. So yes, it's really a very personal decision. Mm-hmm. And you don't really know. In fact, a lot of people, I think, who pull the plug and stop, you find out afterwards, oh, that wasn't that serious. And I hear that more often than people actually pushing forward to be injured. So yes, I think it is. We have there's more in us than what our brain tells us. And usually your body is, your brain is much more, it's like a, you know, your brain is like an indulgent parent. It's like, oh, they're there, you know.
Yeah.
You can just take it easy and stop. And so it's kind of experience. There's not a real good cut and dry answer. I mean, it's what are you, I kind of look at, also the, how much I push myself when the terrain is very treacherous and rocky. Mm-hmm. You know, I will be much more cautious because I do have to get up and go to work the next day. And when I was,
And recovery from injury, in my experience, is much slower the older you go.
And I have been working my way through a technical section and have a young person go flying by, and it seems that they don't even touch the ground. Their feet, mm-hmm. kind of dancing across the top of the rocks, and they just keep flying down the hill. I can't risk that. It's a very personal thing. But as far as knowing that difference, usually my approach to that mental is to pretty much say, if I get that feeling like I can't go on, don't believe it at first, and test it out and keep going. And then if the pain persists and gets more intense and gets worse, then, you know, reevaluate. But don't. I try not to let my brain be that that overindulgent parent that is trying to lets my body be coddled. And so, for instance, my foot issue, I pressed on and I was, the recovery of my foot was still sore 3 months later. I mean, the injury took a while to heal. Now, it didn't stop me from running, but the soreness was there. So,
I think that seems like a reasonable plan. I think you don't give in to begin with, because if you did, nobody would ever finish these.
That's true.
But I do think that, I have a friend who's a physical therapist who had said the difference between an injury and pain is you can put your finger on injury. Her notion being that if you had actually hurt, your knee or your hip, you can almost put your finger on the spot and say, this is the part that's hurt. Mm-hmm. Whereas the pain tends to be more of a radiating thing, a general sense of, boy, my legs are killing me. Boy, generally my knees are sore. As opposed to one or the other. And I think there's sometimes it's a little bit like one of those things where, can I define the difference? No, but I know it when it happens. Can mm-hmm. I tell you what it is? No, but I can tell you when there, sometimes you're coming down a slope and a knee hits a certain way and you feel a kind of a grinding in it that says, that wasn't just a normal hit. Mm-hmm. Something unusual happened. And now I have to ease through it for a few miles and see if it's okay, see what's going on with it. I fell down training a couple of years ago. Shocking, because I'm sure you've never done that. I fell down and it was great because I was finishing a 16 miles or something on a lot of hills on a trail with lots of rocks. And I just caught a toe and did one of those giant, you know, smash down into the rocks and mm-hmm. whacked my knee open and blood's pouring down my leg. Not enough to get stitches, just enough to get your attention.
You're right.
And I'm this all happened in front of an older couple who were out having a nice quiet walk on the trail. And I flew past them and did one of these like, and I get up and I'm bleeding and they have this look on their face like, oh my God, should we call an ambulance? And I bounce up and I'm like, I'm all right. And take off. Mm-hmm. After like swiping at the blood on my knee and like, yeah, I'm good. And I took off and it was funny because I thought, I've only got 3 miles to go. And it made me laugh because I thought there are so many people whose response to that would be, what are you out of your mind? What are you? You only have 3 miles to go. I'm like, well, yeah, but it's okay. It's not a big deal. And you know,
the bleeding will stop eventually. Yeah.
Eventually. I mean, that's how bleeding works. One way or the other, it stops. Yeah. But I do think it's the older I get, the more, just as you mentioned, I'm careful about things like the falls because I just don't want to be, I don't want to be taken out of running for 2 months, 3 months, a year, mm-hmm. because I just do some kind of crazy injury that I really struggle to get over. And so I think it's good to have sort of a test in your head that says, okay, where is my head really? What do I really know about what's happened to me here? Is there any kind of metric that I can go through in my head that says, am I really hurt, or am I just hurting? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's interesting though, because once you turn off the automatic warning device, you know, it's a little bit like pressing the reset on a circuit at home that keeps popping. You can keep pressing reset. But there's a reason it keeps popping. Mm-hmm. And at some point you have to call an electrician.
Yes.
At some point you can't say, I just can't keep pressing this. So I think it happens. I think it matters how early in a race it happens, how otherwise strong you feel, and how much you feel like you're in your head. Mm-hmm. You know, and by that I mean have control of your head. Mm-hmm. I think the most important thing at a certain, I was racing years ago, I got along next to a guy who was probably about 41 years old, maybe, I'm going to guess. And boy, he was struggling. He was having such a hard time. It was a 50 miler, the Bull Run Run. And he was having such a hard time. He'd never done one before. And I ran up on him in the woods and he was just dying. And I was like, hey, how you doing? Oh, I'm so tired. And we started running together. And he said at one point, I said, well, why don't you just come with me? We'll run a while. We'll walk a while. We'll be okay. And we're going along. We're having this great visit. And he said, I feel so bad, you know, being the last one out here. And I said, you're not the last one out here. And it was funny because he had convinced himself in his head that he had to be the last person on the course, mm-hmm. other than me, obviously. And I said, you're fine. I said, just think about what's going on here. And basically I was like, look, it's like all ultras. There aren't that many that are big, you know, unless it's comrades, mm-hmm. They're not big. And I said, there are at least 30 or 40 or 50 people behind you out of this field of runners. And I explained to him sort of like, could you think about it this way, this way, this way. And you could see him sort of grappling through the fog of fatigue. Yeah. To go, oh, I guess that's possible. Anyway, we finished the race. And when we got to the finish line, as we got up to the line, he said to me, he said, you go across first. We were running together. I was like, no, we'll go across together. He said, no, you go across first. So we get across the line. And he said, I couldn't have finished this without you. And I said, you not only could have finished it, you could have finished it faster without me. You just didn't know it. Mm-hmm. And that really is part of it. He got into his head there, that notion of, oh, I'm suffering. It's horrible. And I'm like, yeah, it is. Yeah, when you haven't done it before, that's what it feels like. But, you know, I'm like, your next one will be better. And of course, he's like, I'm not doing another one.
Well, There, a lot of us say that at the end of the race. I'm not doing this again. And then a week later, we're signing up for, you know, or browsing through Ultra Sign Up again.
Hey, I've never done a 100-miler, and all my 50-mile friends are always saying, "Oh, yeah," they're like, "Of course you could do a 100-miler. Why don't you go do one?" And there's a question of what you want out of it. Mm-hmm. I'm always like, "Hey, man, after 12 hours of running, after 12 hours of anything." I'm saying, yeah, I've enjoyed all of this. I want. I'm ready to go do something else now. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of saying, let's go another round of that, I might yet do it. In fact, somebody just pinged me the other day about the Javelina, saying, hey, why don't you come out and do the Javelina 100? And I'm mm-hmm. like, I think that's kind of a hard race, I think, isn't it?
It is deceptively difficult. If you look at the course, the layout of the elevation of the course. Yep. I mean, it's a gradual uphill for. Uh-huh. 10 miles and a kind of level, then gradual downhill. The second half is pretty much just, it'd be like almost a groomed mountain bike trail. Hardly any, you know, just, it was very, 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 feels very runnable. But it's hard. It's harder than it should be. Even when I was out there running it, I kept thinking, This feels like it should be easier, and it wasn't.
You know something I love about this conversation? This is another thing I like about the running community, particularly the ultra community. To know that the rest of humanity thinks this part of the conversation is stone crazy. It's a 100-mile race. It's harder than it should be. Like, it's a 100-mile race. They're all kind of hard.
Yeah. Well, no, I had only signed up for the Jackass, so I was just a 20-mile loop. You know, I didn't have the time. You know, I was out there for something else, and so
yeah,
like, okay, I don't have the time to do the full 100, and having run on the course, 100 would be tough out there.
Here's a question for you: if I wanted to do 100, am I better off to choose a typical ultra course, which is hills and creeks and all that kind of stuff that we get used to? Or would I be better choosing one of the rare ones, like, I can't remember what it's called. There's one that's on like the CNO canal or something, but it's basically flat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The whole way. So you're doing 100. So it's what is that race? It's like you do like 21 direction, then you do like 50 back past the start line and then 30 back. What is that one called?
It's down in Florida.
No, there's one here too.
There's long haul down in Florida.
Okay, so what do you recommend? Do one that has the trails or go for the flats? Both of which have things that recommend and hurt you about them.
Yes. My preferences would be trails. With
hilly trails?
I would
flatter trails. I would prefer trails, yes.
Yes.
But trails often come with a mix of hills that are.
I would say a mix of hills. The flatter races for me, I think, would be harder. Because, I guess, from my experience, because my first attempt at 100 miles was the Hawk 100 held mm-hmm. in Lawrence, Kansas. It's a looped course, 25 mile loops, pretty technical.
Really?
A lot of rocks, not huge hills, but there are hills. I like that. You know, I was doing well. I got 84 miles in before I missed the cutoff. And the rain came in the middle of the night. And after 3 hours later, you couldn't move without falling down on the trails. They were so slick. Six weeks later, my running friend said, "You're ready. Let's go down and do this one in Oklahoma," which was all on gravel roads. Now, it was not level. They advertised it as mostly flat, and there was about 1,000 feet of elevation every 10 miles. So, what is that? 10,000 mm-hmm. feet. So there was hills, but I was 50 miles in, and I was like, "Could I have a rock or a root to step over?"
Yeah,
and it was because and I had trained I had trained on trails. I mean, I was running this trail race. And so I had done maybe 15, 20 miles total on the road that year in training. And then I'm 30 hours was kind of where I was at as far as finishing, and 30 hours of, the same motion over and over and over just wore I was not ready for that.
It's tough. And I 100% agree. The variety of trails, especially sort of gently rolling trails, is wonderful. In fact, funny, I should mention Stone Mill and all of this. Stone Mill has a section in the middle from roughly 26 to 29 miles, maybe, where you're on the CNO canal path, which is as flat as a pool table. And almost all of us say that is the hardest part of the race. Mm-hmm. Because you've been rolling through hills all morning, you're going to roll through hills all afternoon, and you hit that flat section where the sun comes out, and we're all just like, I just hate this. Just get me off of this and let me fly again. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I don't know what I'll do about that. I mean, I appreciate your thoughts on that, because it's, I think it would be fun to do, but as I wrote in my book, the challenge of long distance running is not so much getting fit as getting it too fit into your life, because mm-hmm. there are so many other things. Yeah. And it's time consuming. And as much as I love it, and good gracious, this morning, today I'm parched because I was just doing 9 miles of speed work to get ready for fall. And when I'm just ultra running, I do no speed work. Yeah. But when I'm trying to race for a marathon, I have to do speed work. And it was hot and humid here. And it was just one of those. It's like it's only mm-hmm. 9 miles. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you're thinking, man, I am dying out here. And I kept stopping because this is the ultra running part.
Right.
The blackberries are like at perfect stage right now, and they're all along the trail. And a lot of the water fountains are still turned off because of COVID out where I run. So I just kept stopping and grabbing fistful of these berries mm-hmm. to eat them, to get a little bit of the sugars and some of the liquid into me. And that is the great part of ultra running, I think, is not just the time you spend on the move. That's all great and wonderful. But also it's the moments that you spend stopping or the moments you spend walking mm-hmm. because you suddenly realize, gosh, I just came into this completely beautiful and lovely scene where the berries are ripe or whatever it is. And I'm out here to enjoy myself. So it's okay to stop for a minute and just look at the river or watch the sun go down. Although I'll tell you about the sun going down. My wife finally convinced me to start running with a headlamp. Because for a longest time, I was just not doing it. I would mm-hmm. just go out and I'd say, I'll be fine.
I'll get back in time, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right, right. And I ended up running some crazy, I mean, there were times when it was dark, dark. And I was still in the woods. Mm-hmm. And I was flying along in the dark and sort of saying, pretty sure this is the right path. Pretty sure I'm going. I write about it in the book about getting lost outside of Las Vegas.
It was a trail that you weren't normally on.
Yeah, I was traveling for work and I got lost and it was dark, dark. And I was running to the wilderness and I was like, man, I'm kind of dead reckoning where I think I'm going, mm-hmm. but I don't know for sure. And that running after dark was quite a thing. I came very close to running into a deer one night. I didn't. But we startled each other because suddenly I realized in the gloom, I'm like, wow, I am an arm's length away from this bad boy. And he's scared and I'm scared. And boy, are we startled out here. And those are the moments too, particularly, and it's funny because when it snows and you run after dark, it's fine.
Cause you can see. Light. That's beautiful.
A lot of light, yeah. Right? But on really cold nights when it hadn't snowed and it was just dark and I was out there, that's part of what my wife kept coming around to. She's like, if you go down out there, especially at the distances you're running, we will literally have no idea where to look. Mm-hmm. And nobody's coming till morning. Yeah. There's nobody going to accidentally stroll up on you.
Yeah.
So if you do something bad enough that you can't move, it's not going to be good.
Yes. So, and at those temperatures, that's
right.
Because you can't dress for like spending the night laying in the woods while you run.
Well, that's the interesting thing. That's the thing about winter running, but it's so weird to be talking about winter running right now. That's the thing about winter running. you know, you know how it is. It's like, okay, if you dress so that you're cold for the first mile and a half, you've dressed about right. Mm-hmm. Otherwise you're going to be hot for the rest of it.
Yes.
And, but then it's like, okay, I have to keep going. In fact, my first 50 miler, I fell in with this guy near the end and he and I were both kind of struggling. He was like a good ultra runner. He had done a bunch of it. And, I was like, we were both like, oh, we have to keep moving because if we don't, we'll freeze. Mm-hmm. It is so cold right now. It had dropped back to about 29 degrees. And we're like, no, we're wet all over and we have to keep going or we'll be done for.
Yes.
Which was an interesting motivating factor. That race was very funny because they had, I know the race director, great, great guy named Barry Hauptman. And they had, that year they had to relay the course and there were some mismeasurements or whatever. So it was really about 55 miles. And, but everyone was thinking it was 50 miles. And I heard some very, very imaginative cursing in the last 5 miles from people who were like, you know, I'm supposed to be done already and I can't believe this.
Ultra runners should be used to that. I mean, it's like,
they should be. It's bonus miles.
Bonus miles. I mean, that race directors do that all the time. It's
like, yeah. You know, I love these. I read an article a couple of years ago about people who have mismeasured marathons. So much so that people have finished the race only to find that it was not a qualifying race.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, they finish and they think, oh man, I just ran the best marathon of my life. Mm-hmm. And then the race director is like, yeah, we mismeasured by like 3/4 of a mile or a mile.
Yes. Yeah. Like,
oh, that'd be good. You'd ask about the news business. I'll tell you a funny story about the news business. Many years ago, there was a guy I knew was doing a story from London and the executive producer of the show, I won't say the network or anything else, but it's sort of a famous story in one company. He mistimed the story. That's back when producers timed them with stopwatches.
Okay.
And he mistimed the story by a minute. He got his math wrong and just overlooked a minute. So much so that the piece could not finish before the show ran out. And it was hot rolling from London, meaning it was rolling at the time it was on the air. And they suddenly had to just cut back to the anchor who had to say, I'm sorry, we don't have time to finish that story. Thanks for watching. Good night. Mm-hmm. Which is a gigantic, huge embarrassment for an executive producer of a show. It just is not allowed to happen. That happened. And the executive producer immediately got on the phone to this like intercom system to London from New York and said, can you give me a call? And the guy there says, we're all a team here. You can tell me whatever you wish. And he said, and they'd had a long-standing disagreement. And he said, I know you don't like me being the executive producer of this show. I know you wish I did not have this job anymore. I got a solution for you. Next time I ask for a minute 30 piece, give me a minute 30 piece, and I will have a heart attack and die. So I've lived my entire career in the world of minutes and seconds. So running fits very naturally into that.
So you say maybe 100 miles in your future, but do you have anything that's coming up that is kind of like a dream race for you that you haven't run yet?
Oh yeah. Well, there are races like that. I really would love to go do Conrad's. Mm-hmm. It just sounds like such an extraordinary race. And I admire the people who run it. I admire the community of Conrad's from what I see of it. I would very much love to do that. I think that would be a lot of fun. There are a few other, you know, there are so many ultras out there that I think I would be thrilled to take part in just because it would be fun to do it. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't mind going. My wife had said to me the other day, she said, maybe you should go out to like, we should go out to where they run Western States and maybe you should just, you know, sort of segment run it, you know, just for the fun of saying, you know, what the course is like. Mm-hmm. I'll never be in Western States. I think it would be a bad thing for all of running if I were. But I think that would be interesting. I think it would be certainly it would be interesting to go to see the folks, you know, launching into Barclays. That would be fun to see, you know, because it's such mm-hmm. an unusual community. So, I mean, those are races out there that I like. There are certain races. There's a race in the Laurel Highlands here, which I'm told is very beautiful and fun to do. I had a friend some years ago who was supposed to be a featured runner at it was part of like Leadville, you know, or around the Leadville race, but they had like a half marathon they were doing. Mm-hmm. And he was supposed to go run this half marathon. At the last minute, he couldn't make it. And he called and he said, "Hey, can you go fill in for me out there?" And I was like, "Dude, are you kidding me? I mean, that's altitude. I am not at altitude and you're an elite runner. You really think they're going to be satisfied with watching me come out there and, you know, watching me wheeze like a concertina? No, probably not." So I don't know. Anyway, there are races like that that I think are in it. What should I try? What do you think would be a great race that I haven't done?
Oh my goodness. And I'm trying to think,
I'll tell you which one I would love to do. Don't think I'll ever do it. Mm-hmm. I would love to do Dragon's Back in Wales.
Okay. Yes.
That looks like such a fun, such an interesting run. I think it's beyond my grasp at this point, but I would, you know, and there's also an ultra run in Iceland that looks like it's fun. Although some of these really big multi-day runs, they seem to become, I don't mean to be kind of invertedly elitist about it. They seem to become such financial ventures. Mm-hmm. That I don't know about that. I like being part of a running community where everyone's out there running, not because everybody, as I think Laz said about Barclays, it's supposed to be a test of fitness, not of finance.
Yes.
And I'm not looking to just be around a bunch of people who can buy their way into just big fancy races. I want it to be a race that has that spirit of a lot of great runners out there having a great time. Mm-hmm. And by great runners, I don't mean fast. I mean people who love running, you know? So, Dragon's Back looks like it would be an interesting and fun race to do. I'm probably wrong about that. Yeah. If you talk to me on like day two or three, I'd probably be like, "No, this is terrible. This is terrible. No one should ever do this."
Yeah, and the one in Iceland looks—I mean, that looks very stark. I mean, I saw some pictures of the.
Yeah, but I love bleakness. Okay. I really do. I'm a huge fan of bleakness. It has always been a thing with me. Like, for example, I love the Great Plains. Mm-hmm. Most people drive through the Great Plains and they're like, "Oh my God, there's just nothing out here." And I'm like, "It's beautiful. It's beautiful." In fact, we have this painting at home that we bought many years ago in South Dakota. I was a kid in South Dakota. And it's up the Great Plains, and I love the emptiness of it. Mm-hmm. I love mm-hmm. that sort of yawning emptiness and the idea that there's nothing ahead except more emptiness. Yeah. So I read a book by Ian Fraser years ago called Great Plains, which is just lovely about that sort of yawning emptiness.
Yeah, there is a beauty to that, especially if you get to be, if you're not in a car. To bike across Kansas, there's people say Kansas is flat, and if you ride it on a bicycle, you'll find out how non-flat
there is. Yeah, well, and you also, there's something that's just really amazing about that. I used to, back in the days when radio was really just AM and FM radio, there were parts of the country out there that I referred to as Radio Free America. Mm-hmm. And by that, I meant you would drive to the end of the signals and you kind of couldn't get a radio signal from anywhere.
Right.
And if you got one, it was sort of scratchy and barely there. And there was something I loved about this. One of the great, and this is a terrible thing to say because it's not really true. One of the things I hate about GPS is how hard it makes for people to get lost anymore. Yeah. Getting lost is a very special kind of adventure.
Well, getting lost with a GPS is even, I mean, because I have had GPS take me on places that, you know, not every place is, you know, on the GPS is going to take you to where you think it's going to go.
No, that's true. They will sometimes they'll find some. You're kind of like, are we supposed to go down an alley? Okay, going down an alley now. That's in the city, not the countryside. You're like, I don't know where I'm going out here.
Yes, I know I've had some of those adventures, but yes, I understand that of looking at a road and going like, I wonder where that goes.
Yeah, it's a great feeling. I remember reading an article years ago in Outdoors magazine or something, I don't know where it was, about how most people don't really know where they are most days. They have a series of symbols in their lives that they follow. which is I go down this road and I turn at this church and I go to this place. Mm-hmm. GPS has changed it somewhat, although GPS has also, I think, made people even less aware of where they are because they just look at the screen and follow the screen. Mm-hmm. But the point of it was that many people could be taken a couple of blocks or a couple of miles off of their normal course, and they have no idea where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things I also like about ultra running when you're out in the woods, as you know, on many races, it is quite typical for a few people to get lost.
Yes.
They miss turns. They run off into the woods. We were running a race years ago, and this guy who's a beast runner, oh my gosh, beast runner, comes burning by fairly late in the race, halfway at least, so that the little group of us, we were all sort of like, well, he must have started very late because he's too good of a runner to have, no way he was behind us.
Mm-hmm.
He burns past us, and we're like, boy, look at that guy go. Boy, he's just put together. And then some considerable amount of time later, he passes us again. And we're like, what's going on with this guy? We get to the finish and we said, what was going on out there? And he said, yeah, I took a wrong turn. I got lost and picked up 9 extra miles.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, really? He got really lost. And I was like, wow, that's a piece of work. But I've had the runs like that. I was running one time in North Carolina, South Carolina, somewhere like that. And this was kind of a semi-urban run. I wasn't in the town, but I was out in the suburbs. And you know how you are. You set off, you're like, oh, I need, 13 miles today, 12 miles today. Mm-hmm. Pretty sure if I go this way and this way, that'll be about that.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. And man, I got turned around and the miles just kept going up and up and up. And I was nowhere. And I was like, I don't know where, how to get back to this hotel. I don't know where I am. And I looped around. I tell you, this guy, such a guy thing to do. It was hilarious. I ran into a sports place. I saw a sports store in a little strip mall thing. I ran thinking, well, a sports person ought to know where things are.
Yes.
I ran inside and I said, hey, I'm trying to get back to this hotel somewhere out here. And he's like, no, I don't know where that is. And I said, well, it's near some kind of chain restaurant, like a Chili's or something. Near a Chili's? No, don't know where that is. It's near a Home Depot? No. He knew none of these places, which is making me think I'm really far away.
Yes.
And then he did this just ridiculous 20-something guy move. I can't remember the exact name of the chain, but I said, well, it's also near, and it was something like a Hooters or something. I said, it's near that. And then he's like, oh, yeah, you go down here. And I thought, God, I was like, dude, this does not look good on you.
So
you don't know where anything else is, but you know where that is. That's bad. But I ended up finishing that run. I actually had to do one of those stupid runs along like the grass on the side of an interstate.
Oh, uh-huh.
That was the only way I could connect to what I needed to connect to without adding yeah. another 4 miles.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of interesting. He would go to whatever place he went to and didn't recognize the Home Depot, which is a
pretty
big landmark.
You would think you would know. You would think, but it's funny. I love the people you meet out. I love the people you meet out on the trails.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I did the same trail where that guy got lost and picked up the extra 9 miles. I was lost one day out on a training run out there, and I came sort of bursting out into this little meadow, and I saw this couple who was coming back the other way, and they looked puzzled. And they were just out walking.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, does this trail go to like that pond? And they were like, we don't know. We're lost too. All right. Good luck to you.
That's funny.
let me get a good image in my head so I can tell the authorities what you looked like.
Well, you'd ask a couple of races. The Javelina, if you're there during the I ran at night, ran the course at night, which mm-hmm. was beautiful. I love the desert at night.
Yeah.
But if you did, 100K, the 100K out there, you would run, and it's desert, and it's a challenging course, but, mm-hmm. I think that would be a good one. A couple of that are close to me, for a 50 mile, if you run it's in Lawrence, Kansas, mm-hmm. called the Hawk 50. Mm-hmm. And so they have a marathon, they have a 50 mile, and they have a 100 mile.
I'm writing this down.
And, that's September. That's the first weekend in September every year. It's beautiful trails. They're challenging. It's mountain bike trails, but there's also, you know, some rocks, some open country. They call it Bunker Hill. There's an old missile silo bunker.
Can I ask a related question to this? Sure. Do you see many chalk outcroppings there?
No.
Because you know the whole Jayhawks
yes.
is based on a chalk outcropping.
I didn't realize that phrase was built on a chalk outcropping.
Rock chalk. Yeah, it was written. It was. I think it was a couple of professors from KU who I think were like geologists or something. I don't know. Something about this rock outcropping, which was famous there historically. And I read in a history book not long ago about how we don't think of these things now, but how chalk, even 100 years ago, was a big thing and a big source of calcium for people. So much so that there were poor people who would literally, when they found chalk outcroppings, would break off the chalk and chew on it.
Okay, I could see that.
To get calcium. Mm-hmm. So I wondered if there were chalk outcroppings. No, that would be another reason for me to see them and say, look, chalk.
Yeah, I know that there's an Oread limestone is what it's called, because the campus of KU, they call it Mount Oread. Typically limestone is the stone that we have. If a geologist found chalk, it was like, it's not something that is common around here. So that's
interesting. Did you go to KU?
I went to KU. Yes.
Oh, did you? Well, congratulations.
Yes. Yeah. It was, I enjoyed it. It was a great experience.
Yeah. I have a good friend who went there.
I was 30 when I started. So,
oh really?
So yeah, kind of a non-traditional student, but yeah, it was great. It was great.
Yeah. I was 30 when I got out of college. So I was kind of non-traditional, different route, you know,
And then there's another one. It's a fairly new race, and I'm trying to remember if they have a 50 mile. It's called Hell Creek, which is in central Kansas.
And right, it is down.
It's Hell Creek Race Series. And Chase Hamilton and his wife Casey are race directors for that. And
I've never raced in Kansas. It would be an interesting place. What do you think about these 50 mile? The people who do all 50 states do like a marathon in all 50 states.
Oh yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I've seen people who do that. I was like, yeah, that sounds like a fun project.
It does sound like a fun project. It sounds like a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. A lot of
a lot of work, right?
A lot of time.
Yeah, that sort of racing around to do all of that. I mentioned Mike Wardian a while ago. Mike just completed this astonishing, you know, one of those runs across America thing. Mm-hmm. And I find that amazing when people do it. And there would be a time in my life when I thought, that's amazing. I'd like to do that. Mm-hmm. Now I just go, that's amazing.
That's amazing.
Done. You know, I've got other things, you know.
I spoke with the guy this morning. He's from Poland. He's in Poland right now. He's coming to the United States. He's going to run the circumference of the world. And so he's starting in New York, going down to Florida, then across the border and end up in San Diego, I believe, and then fly over to Asia and run. He's going to run in all the continents. He's taking a couple of years, 40,000 kilometers. I can't remember.
I love running. I don't love it that much. I really do. There are other things to do, you know.
I know.
Play guitar too. I like doing that.
Yeah. but yeah, it's, and he's a very interesting guy. It's just and he's done similar. So he's done self-supported runs through parts of Asia, and he's done some in Scotland as well. It was a very interesting guy. And
if you have the juice, you know, to run anything, if there were any running accomplishment that you could do, what would you do? Would it be like winning the Boston Marathon, or would it be running across, you know, the Sahara? Would it be, what would be the thing?
I would do the Triple Crown of 200s.
Yeah.
I would do the Bigfoot 200, the Tahoe, and Moab 240.
Really? That would be your thing.
if I had the juice.
so you would continue in obscurity.
Yes. For me, running is very personal. I enjoy the intention. That's part of why I have a podcast. But I enjoy telling stories about running, but it's the reward is very personal for me. And so accomplishing, I feel good about my DNF, first 100-mile DNF. Yeah. I knew I had it, and it was, and that's part of what you talked about. The beauty of ultra running is nobody's guaranteed a finish. Whereas marathons, it's something that has to go really, really pretty wrong for you not to finish a marathon.
Not to finish. Yeah. You'll get to the finish line. Probably. You may not finish the way you want to, but you'll finish. I will say, in a sense, it's funny that when you said those would be your goals, in a sense, I feel like ultra runners are the jazz musicians of running. We just love it so much. We don't care that nobody else pays any attention and they think we're a little odd.
Yes.
Right? Like, oh, no, we don't have any hits. No, any hits? No, no hits. Yeah. Do people like to hear it at parties? No, not that much. But boy, do we love it.
I'll go stand on the corner and play my saxophone.
Exactly. Yeah, but that's a great goal. I guess if I could do, of course it would be great to win something, but that's all in a different world. I guess if I had the juice, I don't know. There's some of these great races like Dragon's Back that seem like it would be just really fun to do.
Yeah.
And to just be part of and to just feel. There's a race in the Yukon that sounds pretty amazing.
Yes.
And I like things like that. I like the idea of people just. Somebody wrote an article a few years ago that had a really interesting idea. This was a runner who said he was championing the idea of saying, for ultra runners, you don't have to run a race. You can simply pick something that thrills you and say, you know what? I'm going to go to West Virginia and run this trail.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm going to go to, Maine and run through the Great North Woods. And I'm going to pick a trail that maybe it's 100 miles long, and maybe I have to have family or friends support me along the way. And there is no race, but I'm going to run it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that idea. I got to tell you, Eric, there are some days I've had runs that have just been really wonderful and special runs. And I call them training runs, but when you run no faster than I do, I guess they're just runs. I'm not sure what the training part is. But
yeah, if you're running, it's training. That's right. If you're moving faster than a walk, yeah.
Yeah, and I have had some that have been beautiful, especially some that, as we mentioned before, when you do time it out right, that it's getting dark as you're finished and the trails are empty.
Mm-hmm.
And you see wildlife and you feel the temperature change and you watch the light change and you come cruising off the trail just as the moon rises. And it's just remarkable. And that's as good as the feeling that I've ever had from any race, and I think sometimes there was a group many years ago called the Woodmen of the World. They were a lumber. I don't know what they were. They're kind of like granges, I guess, out west, right?
Okay.
They were the Woodmen of the World. And my grandfather was somehow tied to that. My mother grew up literally down a red dirt road in a house with no electricity, no plumbing for all of her time living there. And he worked a little farm, kind of, but also worked at a lumber mill. And there was a Woodman of the World sticker on the wall. And there was a something that my grandmother had stuck up somewhere that was like the Woodman of the World prayer or something. And basically the thrust of it was this little sort of poem about how there was this perfect day where all the trees fell right and all the wood split just right and the saws didn't break and everything went exactly right. And this, the woodman was like, this is as good as it gets. There's nothing better than this. And I think that's kind of how it feels as an ultra runner. I don't think I'm ever going to finish first.
Mm-hmm.
Might, maybe, one day. I might win the Boston Marathon. It's not likely. But I don't think I'm going to get first. If I beat the cutoff in a hard race, I'm really happy about that. And if I have a great run, I'm really happy about that. And having a great run, a lot of times there is no one there, and there are no medals, and there is no course marshal. It's just a run in the woods where all of those things, you know, your feet fall just right, and the air moves just right, and you scare up a woodpecker here, and maybe you see a beaver down in the creek over there. And it just reminds me, in a way, of what it was like to run as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you just ran because you could, it's what you did. It was like, hey, let's go over to the field. Great, let's go. And everyone took off running.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just this beautiful and flowing thing. And for a little while, when that happens, I feel like as much as we think about hours and minutes, you can make even years disappear. And for a moment, you're sort of suspended in this perfect time of saying, this is what I'm here for today. This moment of moving through this space and feeling good about it. And if you pass another runner along the way, and you can, you know, give each other the trail nod.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
it's kind of a nice thing. And it makes it a little bit easier to go back to where you started off asking about what's changed about our business and what's changed about our world. I think it makes it a little easier for a little while to say, you know, it's all a pretty good place, you know, mm-hmm. and things can be good and people can find ways to be good with each other.
Yeah.
And to me, out on the trail is one of those places where it happens, you know?
Mm-hmm. Thank you a lot, Tom. I appreciate the time. And tell people how to get a hold of you if they wanted to connect with you.
I'm on all the social media things, you know. Instagram and Twitter are probably your best bets. I don't spend really much time on Facebook ever anymore, once in a blue moon, you know. But it's Tom Forman, CNN.
Okay.
Forman with an E, like the boxer, like George Forman. And it's all one word, Tom Forman, CNN. And I usually respond to people, unless they're being jerks. then I just quickly block them and move on. But I love hearing from runners. And I will say this, Eric, the great joy of writing the book, My Year of Running Dangerously. And I've been pecking away at the idea of a second running book. The greatest joy about that has been hearing from people who I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
From all over this country and to a degree from around the world. And suddenly I'll see a note in Instagram or somebody will, you know, they'll post something on Twitter or something that somehow that story of my family and I and what running did for us, you know, resonates with them and makes them feel good and makes them like what they're doing. And I really like that because, you know, my place has always been the middle of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
When I was younger, it was the front of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, for almost all of us, it becomes the middle of the pack.
Mm-hmm.
And I like people in the middle of the pack who are striving to be better. And I like people who have never run a step. And I always say when I speak to running groups, even really experienced, very good running groups, I always say, you know, remember and be encouraging to that person out there who's struggling. Because they're 1 mile, maybe as hard as your 30 miles,
mm-hmm.
you know? So it's nice to see people like that. And I like hearing from people. So hop on, particularly Instagram or Twitter, hop on, hit me up, give a follow. I usually follow back just because I like to hear what people are up to. We'll chit chat.
So before I let you go, I have a tradition I have called the bridge questions.
Who approaches the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side, he see.
Ask me the questions, Bridgekeeper. I'm not afraid.
What is your, since you're training for a marathon, what is your least favorite workout?
Well, you know, my least favorite workout. That's interesting because, as you know, sometimes your least favorite workout is also your most favorite workout.
Oh, yes, yes.
My least favorite workout is probably speed work. Actually, I'm not so certain that my least favorite workout lately hasn't been the long run, just because it takes a lot of time on the weekend. But probably speed work, because speed work can be so challenging and mm-hmm. can be so hard. And yet when you're done with it, it is so fulfilling to right. say, I survived. So I probably enjoy that. Enjoy that and dislike that the most.
Oftentimes those are going to go together.
Hills are good. Yeah. Hills are good. I love hill workouts. I strongly recommend hill workouts to everybody all the time.
Okay. Second question. What is the strangest thing that you've seen while you've been out working, or been out running?
A couple in the woods being very happy.
There is that going on out there.
Yeah. They were happy. And as I ran by, I just said something like, you know, sorry. Carry on. What am I going to say to him? I'm like, okay, you're fine. You're fine. It's okay.
So last question is, what is a word or philosophy, a word or phrase that sums up your philosophy of life?
My philosophy of life?
Of life.
Of life. It has always been, as I mentioned in my book, but I really do believe, if it's inevitable, it's ideal. Meaning, whatever circumstance you find yourself in, whether it's a race or in your life, that is the circumstance you have, which makes it perfect.
I like
that. Because why would you think anything else? It's time to move forward from where you are. You can't move forward from where you're not. You can't waste your life wishing something were better than it is. You can try to make it better, and you can wish it, but don't waste your time on that. Say to yourself, this is where I am right now. This is the perfect place to be. At this moment that I'm saying these words, there is nothing on earth I would rather be doing. You know why? Because this is where I am. Mm-hmm. If it's inevitable, it's ideal. And if you do that, I think it makes a lot of moments happier and more hopeful and more optimistic. Mm-hmm. And it helps you not spend so much time living in the future and not so much time living in the past, which is where I think a lot of people spend a lot of their time. Mm-hmm. And I think it makes a lot of people kind of sad, because they always feel like life is happening in front of them or behind them, but never with them. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, this is the moment. This is it right here, right now. And I think when you do that too, it raises the sense of your desire to say, let me make this worthwhile. Let me do something worthwhile. If I'm going to write a book, let me start today. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to run, you know, 100-miler, let me start training today. If I'm going to, you know, play music, let's do it now. And you'll be surprised at how much you can do if you just start on almost anything. And if you treat your moments like they matter, and if you treat your day like they matter, the one thing I don't want to do, you know, the day will come when I will, you know, when I will flop down and not get up again. But until that moment, I want to embrace each day as if it really matters. And if I really, and as if it, and I don't mean matters in some great cosmic sense, because I'm not a great cosmic force. I'm a speck in eternity. But I'd like my spec to do a pretty good job. And as my younger daughter once said when we were in New Orleans many, many years ago when she was young, she was in her teenager year, maybe 12 or 13, we were visiting New Orleans. And she said, I think New Orleans is the only place where people truly accept the decay and the passage of time. And as such, it's the only place where people are truly alive, because they're saying, here's where we are. This is the moment. Let's enjoy this day. Eat the po' boy today and enjoy it, because when you get hit by the bus, you don't want to look up and say, I could have had the po' boy. You want to say, that doesn't mean be reckless. It doesn't mean be crazy. Uh-huh. But it means enjoy your life, because good gracious, folks, I mean, this is the deal, man. I don't care what you believe about religion or about life or anything else. Right here, right now, this is your day. Don't go to bed tonight feeling like you let this day get tossed away. If it's inevitable, it's ideal. And today is inevitable.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I appreciate that. That is a great way to wrap this up.
And read a lot of books. It's good for you.
Yes.
I read endlessly as a child, and I've started reading a whole lot more this year again, because I felt like I got so caught up in social media garbage that I was reading all day, but none of it amounted to anything.
Mm-hmm.
So this year I've been reading a lot of books, and they've been really, really great. It made me feel really good.
So great. Well, I'll add one question. I had a professor who used to say, if you only had money for one book, buy this one. What's the book that you've encountered that kind of stood out to you?
The Idiot by Fyodor Dostoevsky. The Idiot's a great book. That's a great book. But there's so many great books. It's difficult to say, what's your great book? Well, who's your favorite child?
Yeah.
I read a lot of books. I've been reading this lately. This is The Complete Stories of Truman Capote, which is not very good. But it's useful because it points out to me how even a great author can write bad things, which I think is important. But I just read recently, I read the biography of Frederick Douglass, which is I think it's like an 800-page book that should probably be about a 600-page book. It's good, but a lot, mm-hmm. you know. And I've been reading a book called Testament of Youth, which was written by a young woman who was like 18 when World War I began.
Oh, wow.
And it's really a pretty remarkable book. They made a movie about it with Alicia Vikander, which was a good movie, but that's what made me aware of the book. But I've really been enjoying the book, and it's been just really, really super interesting. And, of course, anything by Cormac McCarthy is, you know, sort of dazzling. Read any book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good feeling, and it helps kind of slow down time, you know, in a way that feels really good in a time when we feel like everything is rocketing forward in such crazy, unpredictable ways. So those are all good things, yeah.
Oh, well, good. Hey, thank you again, Tom. I appreciate it.
Hey, it's great.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and you know somebody who might like it as well, please take just a minute. Send them a link so they can listen. And if you enjoy most of the episodes, please tell your friends. That's the best compliment you can give. I truly enjoy being able to spend time here with you each week, and I appreciate that you take the time to listen. If you have any comments, questions, or stories that you'd like to share, go to ultramindsetpodcast.run, and you can leave a written or a voice message. You can also find the show notes for this episode and more at the same link, ultramindsetpodcast.run. Remember, it takes an ultramarathon mindset to go the distance in running and in life, and a strong mindset is a skill you can learn. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.